back to The Civic Flame. I'm Professor Amber, and today we'll be continuing our discussion of America's least favorite branch of government. In the current race to the bottom, that means the United States Congress, affectionately known as COTUS, or C-O-T-U-S, for Congress of the United States. Last week, we talked about the House of Representatives and some of their important features. Next week, we'll talk a little bit about elections. And I invite you to follow along in your own constitution or on the National Constitution Center's website. Article 1, Section 3 establishes the Senate. Ready to learn about the legislators who think they're the big kids on the playground? Grab a seat by the fire and let's go. At the time I'm writing and recording this, the United States government is still in shutdown. There are several questions about why, some including Mike Johnson doesn't want to swear in the Democrat who just won, who would throw the last vote in favor of releasing the Epstein files. Others blame the Democrats in the Senate for not coming to some kind of agreement. And who really knows? It's probably a combination of a lot of things. This is not my first and likely won't be my last government shutdown. But what does that mean? And how does that happen? Well, in order to pass legislation, the House and the Senate have to both pass the same legislation. It has to be identical. Then it goes to the president's desk for a signature, or not in the case of a veto, which we'll talk about in Article 2. In this case, the legislation was the U.S. budget, and the Senate refused to compromise because the Senate Democrats felt Republicans were cutting too much from Medicare and Medicaid, and Republicans felt the Democrats were asking too much. Tale as old as time, the only difference is they couldn't get it done. Well, I guess that's not very different, is it? There are a lot of internet speculations going around that this has to do with the House of Representatives, that it has to do with stonewalling the release of the Epstein files, like I said before, that they are protecting very wealthy and well-connected people around the world who are actually guilty. I don't know what the case is, but we do know that our government is currently being paid while not doing their jobs. But let's assume the government function, I guess that might be a high bar, but let's assume it's open for business. When that happens, what does the Senate do? Well, fittingly for the times, the first clause in Article 1, Section 1 starts with a clause that has actually been changed by the 17th Amendment. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. That part makes some level of sense, but you'll notice that first part of it is chosen by the state legislature. See, originally, the Senate was chosen as a balance of power between popular sovereignty, the we the people thing, with the House being closest to the people, and states' rights. The Senate represents whole states and the state government in the legislature. And so the federal power went to the president, but the Senate was sort of that balance between what the crazy rabble on the ground wanted and what the state legislature wanted. It was supposed to be a bit of a bigger hedge against federal overreach in Congress. In the early 1900s, this really started to change at the state level. And that provided the way to make the 17th Amendment, which became obviously a constitutional amendment, that said, no, the Senate should be elected by the general population in the same way as the House of Representatives. But the other part of the clause is also important, because not only are there two senators from every state, but they serve terms of 6 years. The two senators, that was your compromise. In the House, everything is set up by population. So the bigger the population was, the more the votes. The Senate was meant to stand as a guarantee that less populous states would not be totally overruled by larger ones. But with the way populations have moved over time, the Senate is very unevenly divided. Now, the goal was always some amount of sustainable inequality, but it remains to be seen if the demographic and migration trends will even out across rural and urban states, across north and south, across east and west, and so on, bringing them more in line to equivalent population growth. If it doesn't, this is just going to lead to more antagonisms in our political system. So now that we have that all knotted up, what's the whole thing with the 6-year term? I'm so glad you asked. Notice how this is different from the House of Representatives that we talked about last week. Remember, each member of the House, all 435 of them, are up for re-election every 2 years. So if you want to change the whole House of Representatives, you can basically do it every election. The Senate, however, is staggered, and it has been staggered since the beginning, so that two-thirds of the Senate is the same in any given year. This means if a senator from your state runs for election in 2020, they won't run again until 2026. Your other senator might run in 2022, which means they'll run again in 2028. And since you only have two senators, in 2024, there won't be any Senate candidate on your ballot. So each one serves 6 years, but the elections are staggered for members. Aside from getting to rack up years served with less effort than the House, what else do these guys do? Well, much like the House of Representatives, they work on committees a lot of the time. But I would argue that they do more work on committees because you have about the same amount of committees in the House and the Senate. The difference is, in the House, you have 435 members to be on those committees. And in the Senate, you've got 100 members to be on those same number of committees. So remember that while you have the two different bodies with the House and the Senate, when they pass legislation before sending it to the president's signature, it does have to be identical. And that can make a lot of different wrangling because your 435 members of the House each represent a very small district of people. Your senators represent an entire state, and both of them represent the same state. So it can get a little bit hinky when we're trying to make decisions or compromises. Think about how the priorities change from the House to the Senate. In the House, you're representing one small part of a state, your district. You've got about 700,000 constituents to worry about, and you might have more in common with another House member from another state than you do with your own senator, particularly if you're of different political parties. As a senator, you represent the whole state. That means you're playing for a bigger field than most reps, although there are some states that only have one rep. So what you're doing and what you're representing and whose interests you're going to respond to are a little bit different in the Senate. But just like the House has powers that the Senate doesn't have, for instance, all bills with money need to start in the House. They have the sole power of impeachment, and they have a lot of investigative powers. The Senate has some powers that the House doesn't too, and they're pretty important. The Senate gives advice and consent on people like ambassadors, members of the cabinet. That's your Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, basically every secretary of so-and-so. And very, very importantly, they're supposed to, and with the notable exception of Merrick Garland during the Obama administration, they do weigh in on the president's choice of Supreme Court justices. Remember, the president nominates people in these positions. Usually, they go talk to one of those committees that we just mentioned for a discussion, then they get released into the wild of the whole Senate. And basically, the Senate asks them a bunch of tough or weird questions if they don't like them, and a bunch of softballs if they do. It's not a perfect system, but that's the government for you. But much like the House, you have different qualifications clauses that tell us what these folks need in order to be in the Senate. Remember, you got to be the ripe old age of 25 to be in the House. The Senate's a little different, but honestly not much. The qualifications clause for the Senate says, "No person shall be a senator who shall not have attained the age of 30 years and been 9 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state for which he shall be chosen." So you've got to be a little older to make it into the Senate, and 9 years a citizen of the U.S., as opposed to the 7 years for the House, and you've got to live in your state. This has caused some political question marks with people like RFK Sr. and Hillary Clinton, who both, at different points, were senators from New York State, and both, at different points, accused of being carpetbaggers or folks who move for opportunistic political and economic reasons. But they were still both elected, and that's between them and New York. Beyond these qualifications, you can't add anything. So much like the House, no term limits, unless by constitutional amendment. You might be thinking, but Professor Amber, what about the cost of campaigns? I assure you, the Constitution says nothing about big shiny bags of money. The First Amendment has been interpreted, however, to say that money, in this case, is a form of free speech, which raises questions about corporations that donate to both political parties or candidates. But the Supreme Court says we don't need to worry about that, so it's probably fine. Also, weird, the vice president is technically the president of the Senate, but that function is usually reserved for the president pro tem, who is chosen by the Senate. It's not the same as the Speaker of the House, which is a specific constitutional role in the House of Representatives, elected by the House of Representatives. It's a little bit more freeform, which I think shows you that the founders trusted the Senate a little bit more than the House. But there have been a few times when the vice president has acted as the president of the Senate to break a tie vote. And in fact, all three recent vice presidents, Vice President Vance, Vice President Harris, Vice President Pence, all cast some kind of tie-breaking vote within the Senate, which shouldn't be surprising given how very divided our government has been, that more of these votes are really coming down to the wire. We can ask about what kind of politics that gets us, but that's a bit of a different question. The other power that is reserved to the Senate is the power to try impeachments. Now remember, in the House, they have the sole power of impeachment. So when the Constitution wants to say, only you have this power, that's what it does. And it says, only the House of Representatives can do this. But that sole power of impeachment means even the president cannot pardon someone in cases of impeachment. That's also in the Constitution. But the Senate does get to try the impeachment trial and determine whether to remove someone from office, which I don't think they've ever done. And so the clause, the relevant clause from the Constitution there is, judgments in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. But the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to the law. So basically what this means is you have your impeachment in the House of Representatives, assuming you are Andrew Johnson or Bill Clinton or Donald Trump, and you are impeached, then that goes to the Senate. And that's basically all that happens with the House of Representatives and the impeachment. It's kind of a stamp that goes on your permanent record. The Senate can run with that and say, we're looking at this trial, we're looking at everything, we are going to decide whether or not this trial warrants removing you from office. Again, they've never done that. So they could remove somebody from office. We don't actually know what would happen in that case because it's never happened, but they could. Either way, that is the extent of it. Either saying, yes, you are impeached, but we're not going to do anything about it, or yes, you are impeached, but we're going to remove you from office. That ends that impeachment. What it doesn't end, well, it doesn't end the impeachment. Whether you're impeached or not, up to the House of Representatives, whether you're removed or not, up to the Senate, neither of those actually have a bearing on any of the law outside. So if you are impeached for some legal issue, right? So Bill Clinton, it was obstruction of justice. So you can still have whatever criminal or civil penalties are related to that, right? You can still be subject to, as it says, indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to the law. Whatever goes on with your impeachment in the House or that trial in the Senate doesn't really affect what goes on outside. The idea is you have one set of punishments for people who are in a higher level of public trust, ergo we can remove you from office if you breach our trust, and you have one set of punishments for you as the individual citizen who is not to be above the law. And so it can be, you know, pretty interesting. And so it offers us some questions as a people, what does happen if the Senate eventually upholds an impeachment and says, yes, kick somebody out of office. And I think at that point, it will be very dependent on who it is. Because remember, the House can impeach people who are not just the president. When it's the president, we see it on the news. But like they impeach Samuel Chase, I think it is, Chance, one of the justices, one of the judges on the Supreme Court. Nothing happened. Again, his trial was not withstood in the Senate. So you can absolutely impeach people across different levels of government, but it's just not something that really happens. And the idea of actual removal from office, particularly the president, is not something that happened. Some people wrongly think Nixon was impeached. Articles of impeachment were drafted, but Nixon actually never went through the process, which is why Gerald Ford was able to pardon him. But that's something we'll talk more about in Article 2. Thank you. Okay, today we've gone into the deep dive that set up the Senate and the House. You probably heard my child who's home on holiday from school lurking around in the background. Next week, we'll go no kids and maybe just cats. And we're going to aim a little higher up and do articles 4 through 7 all at once. If it looks like that's getting too long, we'll split it up into articles 4 and 5. But maybe next week or this week, depending on when you listen, the government shutdown will be over. I guess we'll have to see what the future holds. In the meantime, go to senate.gov and figure out who your senators are. Send them a letter or an email telling them they're doing a good job, if they are, or directing them towards a better policy, if they're not. Remember, whether you voted for them or not, their job is still to represent you. Follow me at Dr. Fun Sponge on Blue Sky, Instagram, YouTube, where I've posted only a few videos so far, and TikTok, although with my patience with that platform is very limited, so we'll see how that goes. But until next time, keep the civic flame burning bright, and thanks for joining the good fight. The Civic Flame is a Dr. Fun Sponge Media production with creator Amber Veo and sound producer Matthew Munyon. As always, thank you for listening.